Hey, you made it. Thanks for joining us. Our guest today is Chris Hammerin, who is the VP of Revenue Operations and Growth at SVT Robotics. Chris focuses on marketing, sales, and customer success. And in the tech community, Chris is known as the person you call when you need to scale a startup company quickly. Chris joins us this week to share some advice on startup growth and fundraising. Oh, it looks like Chris is ready to get started.
Sure. My name is Chris. I've been involved in the technology space for my entire life. Over the past 10 years, I've spent most of my time working in startups, specifically in Toronto. My focus is growth, sales, systems that power the go-to-market functions for typically product-based high-scaling companies. I now actually live just outside of Washington, D.C. in Northern Virginia.
Nice. Chris, great to have you on the show. So we've got a bit of a personal connection. We met last year at the Shop Here program, and we were helping brick and mortar companies here in Toronto to switch to e-commerce and specifically to a Shopify model. So you were leading some of those efforts to scale up the company that we were with. We actually helped thousands of stores to go online during the lockdown, during the pandemic. And I know since then, you've actually gone on to help a bunch of other companies to scale up and meet some of their new challenges. So maybe we can start there. What have you been up to since you've left Shop Here, and what are you doing now?
Sure. So after I moved on from Shop Here, which I'd love to talk a little bit more about, I went back to working for startups. So Shop Here was a nonprofit organization under a company called Digital Main Street that tightly partners with the City of Toronto and province of Ontario, and at times across Canada. So right now I'm with a company that I've just joined 2 weeks ago called SVT Robotics. This is their saying, be exothermic. In other words, give off more energy than you take in.
Nice.
SVT you can think of as the MuleSoft of robotics. If you don't know MuleSoft, you might know Zapier or Tray or those types of tools. Mm-hmm. Imagine that tech, which automates connecting systems instead of writing custom code, in the warehouse, connecting robotics to ERP systems, WMSs, things like that. So very, very fascinating industry. I think the team is incredible. The potential of this company is incredible, and I'm happy to be part of it. My focus is really to scale marketing, sales, and customer success, the go-to-market functions, combined with looking for opportunities for explosive growth.
Yeah. And I guess I sort of describe you as the person that people call when they want to scale up their company, right? Would that be accurate?
Yeah, pretty much. I also get calls. You know, I worked with Digital Main Street 5 years ago when they just got started to implement HubSpot, for example. So I can do things like help people get their initial system set up, all the way to looking for opportunities to grow. Ultimately, though, I prefer to join a company, as I have with SVT, really go all in on, you know, and my entire focus is SVT and that sort of thing. So I'd rather do that than be fractional. But I still definitely help people out on the side who are looking to scale or grow.
Yeah, and maybe we could talk about that a bit as well. So I'd like to also focus a bit on some of your personal journey. So you've always been super kind to me, and I found out during our conversation offline that you've actually been mentoring new Canadians for about the last 7 years, or 7 years in total. And as someone who's new to Canada myself, that part of your story definitely stood out to me. And I'd love if maybe you could share some of that with our audience. Maybe tell us about some of your success stories.
Yeah, so this would be about 7 or 8 years ago. I got involved in this through a friend of mine, Lised. She was working with a government-funded nonprofit called ICTC, Coaching to Career. Really, the problem that they were solving was there's a lot of new immigrants to Canada, specifically in this case with a technology background, who sort of expected to, you know, get off the plane, walk into the new rental or house that they bought, and within 4 weeks have a new job, right? And often when people arrive, they have, let's say, a year of savings, something like that. And as that clock starts ticking and it gets closer to them emptying their bank accounts, and they're struggling to find jobs. They're struggling to interview. They're struggling to build a resume they're confident in. They're struggling in the interview process and things like that. So ICTC really helped with the resume construction and the interview process. But at the end of that sort of little program that they had, they'd partner the candidate or the new immigrant with a coach and for a one-on-one experience. Yeah. So this wasn't one-to-many or things like that. This was very, very personal. And it was incredible for me because, you know, I learned things like, you know, based on the questions that were asked, how do I take the subway? How do I get around, you know, they asked this in the interview process, they asked this question. I didn't understand it, so I don't think I answered it correctly. So you kind of take all of that together. Mm-hmm. And for me, I learned a lot more about how to work with people who aren't potentially look like me and are from my background and things like that. It helped me understand the lens and that other people look through and really build that empathy out. So, you know, on the interview questions, for example, you know, if you don't know, for instance, this is a great piece of feedback. If you don't know the answer to or what the interviewer is asking, ask them to restate the question. Tell them you don't understand the question.
Yeah.
But a lot of people, based on the countries they came from, that's not appropriate. Mm-hmm. You're supposed to understand the question. And if you don't, that's your fault. But here, it's totally cool. People, for the most part, should be totally cool to restate the question and help, you know, help them in that process.
Oh, you're absolutely right. I think even for me, that was a difficulty, just being able to feel comfortable with doing that. With pausing, saying things like, oh, you know, give me a second and I'll think through the question, or asking them to restate the question. Something that was really important for me as well is just having someone who's from Canada look through, or someone who's in from Canada and also a professional in my field, look at my resume. Because even though I sort of had it laid out correctly, I didn't understand the way that other people were reading the resume and what information they were gleaning from it. So having someone with that experience definitely helped to, one, boost my confidence so that I can understand what are other people thinking, but then have just a better way of presenting myself based on what I now know that they were looking for. And it helped a ton.
Totally. You know, some of the people that I coached, for instance, when they first started, they would have a picture of their family on their resume,
mm-hmm.
for example, because that might have been common from where they're from. Here, I think that creates a negative response in the interview process, rightly or wrongly. But that's what happens. I think the other thing I think about a lot is if a white male from Canada who grew up pretty well, like with a good background and, you know, money and all of that stuff,
mm-hmm.
if they see a job posting, and they see a list of 10 requirements, and they have two, they will apply and just assume they can learn the other eight. But almost everybody else thinks completely the opposite to that, whether it's women, minorities, new immigrants. They look at that and say, well, I only have 8 out of 10, therefore I should not apply to that job.
Yeah.
So I think that's something else that I think that touches on the confidence factor
mm-hmm.
that you're mentioning there, which is I think that coaching to career program helped build confidence. There's the candidates that I worked with, they all found great jobs. They all have incredible careers now, and that's amazing. All that really happened was confidence and localizing their experience.
No, for sure, 100% on that. So, like for me especially, I've run into that as well. So, applying for jobs, and you sort of look and you see, like, you need 3 years of experience in one thing, but I've only got 1 or 2. And so I'm thinking, oh man, I should probably shy away from that one. But then having these conversations, you recognize that even though you don't have the 2 years, during the interview, there are opportunities for you to show, you know, how you can make up for missing those years of experience, or what else you can show, what are the areas of experience you have that can help to compensate or complement what else you have going on. So there are definitely lots of opportunities there.
Yeah, on that note as well, I think the other part of it is understanding when they ask for, let's say, 3 years experience, understanding how to relate what experience is.
Mm-hmm.
So is running a podcast experience in tech or marketing?
Yeah.
You know, is working at Shopier experience? So that's the other part of it, especially with new immigrants who come from very academic-oriented countries,
mm-hmm.
like Iran or like Pakistan or some of these places. They might say, well, I don't have direct experience in that specific role, for 3 years, therefore I don't fit. I said, well, your experience in these adjacent roles actually are directly comparable to that experience. So I think you should not only apply for that job, but believe that you have that experience.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, a lot of it is about belief, too. That you, mm-hmm. I mean, you sort of, you know, we talked about this offline, too. When you go into these interviews, if you go in from a standpoint of desperation, the interviewer sort of reads that, right? And then that doesn't come off very well for the hiring process. So you have to go in with a bit of confidence, some humility as well. You're not sort of being arrogant, but be sure of yourself and sure of your capabilities, what you can accomplish and deliver for the company.
Absolutely. And that comes down to prep. And, you know, I did a lot of that with the coaching, which would be interview rehearsals and really role play and things like that. So, you know, and in those processes, I would throw curveball questions, because I'll give you an example. An interview question that sometimes comes up that is very strange for somebody not from Canada is, what turns your crank? Like, what does that even mean? I don't know how to answer that. And it's actually a biased question towards somebody who's not ESL, somebody who's like the interviewer and things like that. So that stuff still happens. And that is going away bit by bit with mm-hmm. even powered by some of the hiring processing tools and things like that. But understanding how to handle those types of questions in the interview process as well.
No, for sure. I've never gotten that question, but I think even so, it might take me a second to figure out what exactly that means.
Exactly. Yeah. What turns my crank is getting this job and paying my bills. How about that?
Yeah.
You know, that might be the answer that people really want to give, but it has to be something like solving big problems. You know, you have to come up with something like that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and sometimes you sort of have to take it in the direction that's not as obvious. But okay, so speaking in terms of taking things in a direction that's not so obvious, maybe I can bring this back to the audience, bring them back into the conversation. So a lot of our audience is made up of entrepreneurs, digital entrepreneurs, people who are growth hungry, trying to take their companies to the next level. One of the things that you said to me offline is growth isn't everything. And I know a lot of this for you is based on your work with startups. And so maybe you can explain a bit of that to the audience. Why would you have other considerations in your business other than growth?
Yeah, so I think the first part of that conversation is, let's say you're a digital marketer, or you know, you're a freelance solopreneur sort of role, and you keep thinking about how to grow your revenue, grow your product, grow your business, whatever else. The first step is, when you grow, you're going to introduce new problems that you won't have experienced before. And that's not just you got more money. That's payroll, because you're hiring people. That's hiring and firing. It's contracts, if you're going with the contracting route. Mm-hmm. It's managing people. It's expenses. It's, you know, potentially setting up a board of directors, quarterly reports, all of that type of stuff, or quarterly reviews. So that's what I would say there. And I used to talk to some of my friends who are in this space as freelance digital marketers.
Yeah.
Their time only goes so far. So if they want to make more money, they have two options. Start hiring people and get a cut of their work, basically, or start charging more. And the first thing I would say is, if let's say you're a digital marketer and you're charging $50 an hour, just picking a number.
Mm-hmm.
If you're full time and you don't have any extra time, start charging $75 an hour. Just do that. That is growth, right? It's not what people think of as growth. If you can do that, then you really understand that you're creating value, and customers are showing you that you're creating value because you can increase your price. Then mm-hmm. raise it to $100 an hour. Then raise it to $125. I know some digital marketers that are charging $150 to $200 an hour, for example, but they started at $25 to $50.
Yeah.
So that's natural growth, and that gets you a couple things. One is some funding if you do want to start building out a team, because now you're making more money. The second is potentially you don't have to work full time. And I have friends like that who have said, you know what, I'm going to work 30 hours a week, billing at that rate. I spend time with my kids. I'm going to travel. I'm going to do whatever else. So that's sort of one part of growth. The second one is, if let's say it's more on the product side, so you've built some sort of product, you know, you've got a couple users out there, things like that.
Mm-hmm.
once you start growing, you better have product market fit. So, or else you're going to start burning money. And this is happening everywhere, especially in the venture space, where people just assume they have product market fit because they have 5 or 10 customers that are paying them a bit of money. But as soon as they grow that to 100 customers, they lose all of them in 6 months. Everybody churns.
Yeah.
And that's because they don't have product market fit. So how you know if you have product market fit is really four things. One is NPS, Net Promoter Score. Are customers happy and will they keep paying, or better yet, even pay more?
Okay.
Are they happy? Do they like you? Not on the service side. Maybe you're having issues with customer support. That's normal for a small company. Churn. Are customers leaving as fast as they sign up? You know, that's, if customers are churning, especially before you start growing, that's a very, very dangerous sign that you don't have product market fit. Growth rate. Do customers organically expand their use of whatever it is that you're doing without you having to sell them? So if you sell them HubSpot, for example, do they start adding users to HubSpot and therefore giving HubSpot more money without HubSpot having to engage in a sales process? So that's just an example of that tool, but whittle that down to whatever it is that that you're doing. And I think the last one is, at one of my startups, we called this, will taking your product away from your customers create a riot? In other words, will they be so upset that they'll feel major pain, that not a literal riot, but they would get, this will be very damaging to them personally, their business, things like that. So if that's true, especially the last one, that's an incredible sign that what you're building is solving problems. Then the second question of that is, does it scale? So anyway, those are two things that I think about with growth. One is, do you actually want to grow? The second is, are you ready to grow?
I like the last one about the riot, because I heard something about that recently where there's this open source developer who was pretty upset that these big corporations were using his code for free. And so he basically updated the code so that the whole thing bricked. It bricked all of the applications that were running it. And people freaked out. It was basically a riot. What do you call it? They had to sort of suspend his account. I don't know if they ever really solved the issue, but it was a big deal to a lot of small companies that were using this bit of open source code. I also want to focus on what you said about the venture capital side, but maybe before I get that, I'll go back to the solopreneur side. I know we've got a lot of solopreneur entrepreneurs here in the audience. So when you're talking about going from $50 per hour to $75 per hour, is that just a simple price hike? Like, you get the exact same stuff for a new price, or are you rethinking what you're offering in order to get to that new price?
I think it depends really on what it is you do. So for example, first, what I would say is, let's say you're billing out, you're working 40 hours a week at the $50 an hour. Let's say that's what you're doing today. You know that not all of your customers are going to keep using your services forever. Let's say you build LinkedIn ad campaigns and something like that.
Okay.
And you know maybe it's seasonal, so you only do it over the holidays or, you know, Valentine's Day or whatever else. So once that's done, they no longer need you and you move on to somebody else. When you go to sign up that new customer, put the higher price in there and see what happens. So so you don't want to drive or piss off your existing customers, but you can start increasing your overall hourly rate by averaging up, you know, like people talk in stocks, averaging down. So averaging up your income across new customers. So that's definitely one. The second thing you can do, and this is a tough one, you're going to have to make sure your contracts are great, is start looking at monthly services contracts. So you say something like, I'm here to support and manage your Google Ads campaigns, let's say. You just pay me $5,000 a month. I'm just picking a number. It could be $2,000, it could be $1,000, whatever else. So let's say you're just going to pay me $5,000 a month. That'll get you up to this amount of SLA and this amount of service. So even if they don't use your whole time, you still get that money, which creates consistency and confidence in your own personal income streams. And it also ensures the customer is not just punting you to next month or next month or next month. Because sometimes you can have issues on the project management side to get things moving at the pace that you want.
Mm-hmm. So let me jump on that last point before we move on then. So something that was recommended to me is when you're signing these contracts, maybe it's something in the SLA, there's is some provision that's made for if the customer decides to move on, there's like a rollover period. Let's say like there's a 3-month period where you continue working with them while they are finding the new person to replace you, and they got to pay you a percentage, or maybe the entire amount, or maybe just a percentage of what you used to make. Is that something that you'd recommend as well?
Yeah. So sometimes if you can get customers on the path of a monthly contract, then it would be something like a 60-day cancellation notice, something like that. So you have to, they have to solve, or they have to cancel you and give you 60 days notice. So then you still have 2 more months of guaranteed income. Unless there's a special provision, you know, for instance, somebody says, I want you specifically from April to December. And then after that, we'll renegotiate. Then you don't need the exit clause. But that's one. The second one is to really make sure you cap the amount of effort that you're going to provide. So if it's the 5K number at typically $50 an hour, but you're going to average up to 75, that's what, I'll just do the math quickly. Let's say it's 75 hours. So you're going to say you can use up to 75 hours of my time on that contract. And then somebody might say, why would anybody buy that? Because they're just prepaying, really. And the answer is because it guarantees that I have those hours committed to you. If you just pay me hourly, somebody else might come in and take all of next week. Therefore, I have no time for you left.
Sure.
This blocks out that time.
I like that. It's a dedicated service. I like that.
Yes.
Yeah. And that.
So it's just thinking about the value that you provide. Like, I think a lot of times new digital marketing consultants, it comes back to confidence, the previous conversation, which is you almost feel like you're on Twitch begging for money, right? Mm-hmm. You don't want to feel like that. Turn it around. Understand your value that you provide. Gain the confidence that you really do provide value and outcomes that customers want to see.
Yeah.
If that's true, they will absolutely make sure that they protect that service.
No, I think you're 100% right.
It's like a balance of power that sort of switches from shifts. Them to you over time. Yeah.
Yeah, and I think it's important to do your best to continue adding value so that you maintain control of that seat of power as well. You don't just sort of want to, you know, do the stuff that's necessary to gain the contract, but then not able to fulfill on it, and having little things involved like dedicated hours where, you know, someone has already bought your time, that definitely works in your advantage. But
absolutely.
Let's go back to the venture capital side. I know you've got some experience there. And it's sort of interesting to me that for the past few decades, like the startup world has really been infatuated with venture capital. And it wasn't always that way, especially in tech. Like at one point in tech, you could spin up a company on your own just at really low prices. But now we've all sort of like moved to this venture capital space, and especially with federal interest rates at historic lows. I know that there's some chatter that they might be going up this year. Let's hope that doesn't happen. But venture capitalists are sort of the new rock stars. No, that's what a lot of people are saying. But actually, you advise small companies to avoid raising venture capital, at least initially, not to raise a bunch of money initially. And I'm sure a lot of people in the audience a lot of the entrepreneurs in the audience especially would like to know sort of your thinking behind that. Can you explain it to us?
Sure. I think it comes down to why are you thinking about bringing in external funding? So that could be venture capital. It could be debt financing. It could be a loan. There could be a whole bunch of different ways in how you raise money.
Yeah.
But why are you looking for it? Is it because you want cash flow? Is it because you want to start paying yourself a salary? Okay. Is it those things? I would say really strongly think about how revenue can solve those problems. So a lot of times I'll see companies chase their tails fundraising for years and years. It's crazy. 3, 4, 5 years trying to raise some money. They might get 50K here, 25K there, things like that. All of that dedicated time to raising money could have been building a product and getting customers and getting revenue, which doesn't result in you having to give up equity, right? Yeah. So and give up a piece of your company. So I think that's number one is why are you raising? raising venture capital is, if you're going to go on that path, you have to really understand that you believe you have what would be called a blitz scaling potential. So can you take what you're thinking about and what you're looking at building or what you've built so far, depending on the stage, and scale that incredibly fast? Okay. You know, 30% month over month, you know, exponential level growth. Mm-hmm. Is there a big enough market for that? Is what you've built, do you have product market fit like we talked about before? Mm-hmm. Do people love what you're building and they just need more features, they need more product, they need more digital ad spend, whatever it might be, to really grow quickly? That's what investors want to see, and that's what they're going to place in terms of expectations on the company. So as soon as you raise money from a professional investor, I'm not talking family offices or your uncle or your aunt or whatever else, but professional venture capitalists, you are going to add an incredible weight to yourself as a founder. Hmm. And that weight is no longer getting customers, growing the revenue, things like that. That's now managing investors and managing those relationships.
Yeah.
Hopefully those are great relationships. Hopefully those are, you're aligned. But I really think about that. So making sure that you have product market fit that's ready to scale and grow fast, making sure you're not just trying to solve cash flow problems, look to revenue to solve that problem. You know, the classic story there, by the way, is the old Airbnb story. So in the early days, it was called Air Bed and Breakfast.
Yeah.
And they, I think it was 2008, might have been 2008, or was it 2004? It was 2008. So in 2008, they were trying to put cash in the bank and nobody would invest in them. So they couldn't raise money. Okay. So they created a breakfast cereal called Obama O's and started selling those. Right. Okay. And they raised, I forget the amount, it's worth looking up, but it's an incredible story. And that was actually a catalyst that helped them finally raise money because it showed how scrappy they can be. That even though it wasn't directly their product or service, that they just needed money in the bank to keep the opportunity to build this company going. So be creative. Think about things like that.
They made a cereal. I've never heard that story before.
Obama O's. Definitely go look it up. It's hilarious.
I've heard of Obama O's. I had no idea it had something to do with Airbnb.
Yep. That was how they put money in their bank to keep, at the time, putting blow-up beds in apartments.
Yeah, yeah. No, I do remember Air Bed and Breakfast from the early days. I remember buying like a gift certificate. My girlfriend and I at the time bought a gift certificate for her parents through the website.
Oh, wow.
Way back in the day. Yeah. But yeah, so...
The last thing I would say on the venture capital thing.
Yeah.
Remember this. So do you want to be the CEO of a billion-dollar company, or are you doing this to make a bit of money? The reason why I ask this is owning 100% of a $10 million business is mm-hmm. better than 10% of a $50 million business.
Okay.
So you have to, and this happens a lot. So once you raise seed, Series A, Series B, Series C, your ownership level, forgetting voting shares and all of that stuff, but your net ownership level can be under 10%, depending on the how much you were diluted per round mm-hmm. and how much you were topped back up. So you could have a billion-dollar company, but really not own that much equity. And also, all of those investors are in front of you. So if you're at a billion-dollar valuation and you sell for $500 million, you get zero.
Hmm.
That's possible. That happens all the time, too. It's happened to a number of Canadian tech startups where everybody's cheering them on for such a great exit, but the founders really didn't make as much as people thought.
Oh wow. Well, tell me then. So what does a good relationship between a founder and a venture capitalist look like?
Radical transparency, for sure. Like, there has to be, like, you have to have that two-way trust to be able to be completely open. I think that's important. The investor has to understand the market and the product. I think it's also, just like an investor has to think about how they pick a founders as a person, as a human being, what their individual traits are like, the same in reverse. That just because an investor is willing to write you a check, really do due diligence on who that person is. Talk to other founders who've raised money from that investor. So go to their website, look at the portfolio, call up those companies, especially look for the ones that did not have a good exit and see how that turned out. So if that investor was still supportive, but direct and things like that for one of their portfolio companies that failed, that gives you confidence that when times get tough, because they always will, Every single startup had their act two, right? Their Empire Strikes Back. They had that difficult time. So when that happens, is the board just going to walk away because their fund is so big? You're such a tiny piece of it. They're not going to show up to the board meetings anymore.
Yeah.
Or they're just going to flip to observer status. Or are they going to be there to fight with you to help get to the next stage?
Oh, I think that's pretty important. So you're actually interviewing your investors much in the same way that you might be interviewed for a job.
100%.
Ah,
definitely. You want to back channel them. Get those references.
Get those references. I love that.
Yeah.
All right. So final question before we wrap up. We've got to get to that Buccaneers game. So a lot of digital entrepreneurs in the audience, a lot of us are looking to the world of crypto and NFTs as the next big thing that's going to sort of disrupt our landscape. And I know you have some interest here. You and I have talked a bit about crypto before. So I'm wondering from your perspective, what are your thoughts and what are some of the new opportunities that are available to entrepreneurs in the crypto and NFT space?
Yeah, so I would say definitely I would never place myself as an expert at all in this space. I'm definitely a it's fascinating to me. So I sort of go back and say to myself, here's my hypothesis. Is there a future, or I believe there's a future, where there's some sort of virtual or hybrid world, which they're currently calling the metaverse, powered by digital assets, NFTs, for example, digital currency, you know, Ethereum, Bitcoin, etc., and decentralized data on the blockchain. You know, we're already seeing interesting things like these DAOs in terms of voting structures and things like that. I believe that is definitely possible. I also believe that the current most powerful politicians and countries in the world are not excited about that future.
Okay.
Right? That's not interesting to them because decentralizing currency is a big problem. Decentralizing assets is a big problem. How do you tax this? What do countries look like in the future? Those types of questions, I think, scare them, and I think they get blocked where they can. Just like when we went from CDs or records to through Napster to Spotify, like that difficult process, or Blockbuster and cable to Netflix and now Disney Plus and everything else. So it's going to take a lot longer than people think. You know, having an Oculus doesn't mean I'm in the metaverse, right?
Okay.
But I think it's definitely an exciting, interesting future. If I would say this, though, on the metaverse side, if people haven't grabbed an Oculus Quest 2 or haven't played with one at all, I think before you form an opinion, put that on, you know, interact with a few different games, a few different social places, things like that. See what that looks like and really understand that that's pretty fascinating and very early innings, but think about the potential. And the second is look at places like Decentraland or Sandbox, I think is another one. I can't remember the name. Don't just look at those things from the sidelines. Sign up, get in there, play with it, go on OpenSea. You know, research Coinbase's new marketplace coming out for NFTs. Like, go look at those things in detail and figure out where you matter. Don't just try and mint a series of NFTs, although it could work. You never know. But really dig into it. Like, really dig deeply into it. And lastly, I would say this. Right now, we're in a bit of a crash in crypto, or so-called light crash. There's all sorts of reasons for that. But really think long-term with this stuff. Like, that's what I would recommend is that, you know, when you talk to especially some of the best VCs in the world, they say things like, I keep all my money in Bitcoin. I don't trade it. Bitcoin is my money now. Right? So I don't think about it like that. I don't think about the price of Bitcoin anymore. That's just changing the ratio of how much I can acquire with Bitcoin, just like how much I can acquire with the US dollar. So think long term for sure.
Yeah, I agree with you 100% long term. You do see quite a few people who are doing this sort of for short-term reasons. And the example I use is, and not to call this person out, but you know, one of my favorite artists, Nas, put out an NFT for some of his music. And when I saw that, I started like doing a bit of research into it. And I was kind of disappointed with it because there wasn't necessarily like a roadmap for this NFT or anything like that. And he hadn't put any effort into ensuring how this NFT was going to maintain its value or even appreciate over time. And so it really seemed just like a cash grab, like just using this technology to sell this thing really quickly. You get access to one or two concerts and then that's sort of the end of it. You know, but NFTs, I think, really stand for ownership and not just for the short-term thrill of an experience. It's something that you can have for a really long period of time and even pass on, whether that's through inheritance, you know, or just, you know, sell it at the right time so that you can gain the capital and use that for something else. So it's really about long-term investment, because that's the way that you end up destroying your community. That's the way you end up losing your fans if it's short term.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. I think sort of adjacent to that to me is how NFTs can help artists put more money in their accounts, which they're not putting enough in their accounts compared to what they should be. Mm-hmm. So when you look at, think of like a musician with Spotify, you know, and with the lower amounts of revenue coming in from concerts and things like that because of COVID.
Yeah.
I really kind of hope that people start thinking about this a little bit differently. Like, is there a way to rethink how we distribute music, for example, mm-hmm. right? And maybe, you know, there's original ownership and then there's derivative ownership, like an original painting versus prints, things like that. So, or a baseball card versus a picture of a baseball card, you know, that kind of thing. So super interested. I think just like the internet, when it came out in 1994, we didn't know that was going to end up in where it is today and everything that we're doing today. So nobody would have thought that would create crypto, for example. So what is crypto, blockchain? What is this going to create in the next 20, 30 years? Nobody knows, but I think it's going to be fun to be part of it.
It definitely will be fun. It's going to be a really cool ride. Chris, thank you very much for sharing your knowledge and information with the audience, man. We really appreciate having you on the show. Before we let you go, though, I know you shared a bunch of information and people might want to continue this conversation. You're definitely proving yourself to be a thought leader in the space. So if anyone wants to contact you, what's the best way for them to reach out to you online?
Yeah, so I think just looking me up on LinkedIn, the combination of my first and last name is very Googleable and the one of two in the world. So you can just find me on LinkedIn and hit me up there. I'll accept your connection. And in fact, some of my best relationships and advisory relationships have come from people just reaching out to me randomly on LinkedIn. So totally open to that. Yeah, probably the best place.
Awesome. Chris, it was amazing having you on the show. Hopefully we can get you back in a couple months to give us an update on how things are going with you.
Sounds great. Thanks for your time, Jay.
All right. Thank you.